There are certain regrets in life that fall into the category of what might be called, if I'd only known it was you. I would have behaved differently if I'd only known it was you. Author Lee Strobel shares a story about his father who was approached one time at the Rolling Greens Country Club. Now, this was way back in the late 30s, he was approached by a paper cup salesman who asked if he might invest $950 in a business venture which was guaranteed to pay off big time. Guaranteed. Well, his dad had been around the block a few times before. He wasn't about to throw away $1,000, which back then was quite a lot of money, on something that he had no idea what it was. Well, as it turned out, the salesman, that paper cup salesman, was a guy who turned out to be a guy by the name of Ray Kroc. And the investment would have been to be one of the initial bankrollers in a company called McDonald's. If I'd only known it was you. There's another story that's often told about Mark Twain. Mark Twain was just returning from 3 very successful weeks of fishing in the state of Maine. Now, at that time, the fishing season in the state of Maine had been closed, but Mark Twain fished anyway. On his way home, on the train ride, he started bragging about this large catch to the only person who was there in the club car with him, a person who didn't seem to be very enthusiastic about his story. Finally, Mark Twain asked him, "By the way, who are you?" "I'm the game warden of the state of Maine." "Who are you?" Well, Mark Twain just about swallowed his cigar. "To be perfectly truthful with you, Mr. Warden, I'm the biggest liar in the whole United States. I would never have done what I did. I would never have said what I said if I'd only known it was you." But I think the ultimate regret story along these lines was one that Jesus told about 2,000 years ago. It might be the single most sobering story that has ever been told. I want to put it in somewhat contemporary terms for you this morning. I want to paraphrase it a bit, but it's Jesus' story. If you'd like to look at it now, it's Matthew 25, or if you'd like to go home later today and take a look at it, I encourage you to do so. It has to do with the fact that Jesus said to those listening that day that one day he will return to earth and all of the angels will come with him and he will come in all majesty and power. There will be no doubt about his authority on that day. And we're told that he will separate all human beings by the way a shepherd would separate his sheep and his goats, the sheep on the right and the goats on the left. This is a story about a king. Again, this is a paraphrase of mine. The king will say to those who are on his right, "Come, you who are blessed by my Father, take your inheritance, the kingdom prepared for you from the creation of the world. Because I was hungry and you gave me something to eat. I was illiterate and you taught me how to read. I had no work, I didn't have a job, and you helped me get some training. I was old and sick and alone in a nursing home, and you used to come and visit me. I was out on the streets, and you helped me to find a place to live. I was sitting in prison. I was regarded as a convict to be feared and shunned, and you used to come with me, sit beside me, and give me some hope." And And then Jesus says, the king will turn to those on his left, and the king will say, depart from me, you who are cursed, into eternal fire, prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was starving, and you knew it, but you looked the other way and pretended like you didn't see. I was hopelessly illiterate, and you didn't lift a finger to help me to learn how to read. I was without work, but all you really cared about was your own career. I was alone and old and sitting in a nursing home, and you forgot that I was even there. I was living out on the streets, but your house was on a much nicer street. You never came to visit mine. I was in prison, but your only concern was to make sure that that prison didn't get built in your backyard. Jesus says that those on his left will be quite surprised by the words that he gives, and they will say, when did we see you like this, Lord? I don't remember that ever happening, even once. When did we ever treat you like that? If I'd only known it was you. And Jesus will say these words, whatever you did for the least of these, your brothers and your sisters, you did it for me. And whatever you did not do for the least of these, your brothers and your sisters, you did not do it for me. I'd like for you to imagine carrying that regret into eternity. Now, Jesus is not saying in this story that you have to do good deeds in order to earn your way into heaven. No, he is saying that the ultimate test of the truly spiritual life is a loving and compassionate heart. The Apostle John puts it like this, if anyone does not love their brother or sister whom they have seen, they cannot love God whom they have not seen. If anyone says that they love God, but they do not love their brother or their sister, they are a liar. And I'll tell you, one of the most sobering parts of this story that Jesus told, Jesus does not say to the goats, you oppress the least of these. You went around burning crosses in their yards. You robbed and engaged in acts of violence. You did really bad things against them. Now, instead, Jesus says, you did nothing. You looked the other way. You decided that having a bigger house or maybe a nicer car was worth working really hard for, but helping other people around you in need was not worth it. You decided that you had more important things to do, but you, my friend, were wrong. The day is coming when you will regret that more than you can ever imagine, Jesus says. Now, I'd like to think that everyone in this room here at Woodside Church wants to cultivate a heart of love. Is that a safe assumption? My bet is that even if you're here today and you're not so sure about this God thing yet, even if you're still seeking after the spiritual life, my guess is that even you really have a desire within yourself to have a loving and compassionate heart. So my question to you this morning is, what do you do to get that? I'm going to get really concrete now because I know that a lot of you have busy lives, you have a lot of commitments, you have a lot of things that you just cannot walk away from. How do you cultivate a loving heart? I want to give you one thought. This thought comes from a man by the name of Jim Wallace, who I believe is one of the greatest Christian thinkers around this whole area of love and compassion. Jim Wallace wrote a book a number of years back called Faith Works. And he gives us a starting point for people who want to earnestly want to cultivate loving hearts. So I want to tell you the phrase that he offers, and then I want to work with you for just a moment. Together, I want to unpack this. He says, and I quote, Jim Wallace says, the place to start is here. You've got to get out of the house. Here's the idea. We all tend to live in a little slice of the world where we feel most comfortable. All of us, we like it where it feels familiar, where it feels safe. And so I spend my life, I go to school, I shop, I work, I go to church, I play pickleball with people who are a whole lot like me. Our society divides people up that way. It just kind of puts these real subtle barriers in between different kinds of people. Isn't that right? And as long as I don't get out of the house, people in other conditions, people who are different from me, you know, different languages, accents, different skin color, different socioeconomic groups, they're just not on my radar screen. They're just not in my mind and not in my heart. So usually what transforms people when it comes to the business of cultivating hearts is really not a great talk. It's not an inspirational book. It's not a powerful documentary. It's not this moving film. It's a real life experience that grips your heart and seizes your vision and grabs a hold of you. Jim Wallace is right. You've got to get out of the house. You've got to do that. I have a very deep conviction that if you and I will do that, if you and I will step out of our safe and normal world, you and I will discover how to serve and how to pray for people with real names, and our hearts in the process will be changed. On the other hand, I'm here to tell you this morning that if you don't take that step, if you choose not to get out of the house, your attention will simply be devoted to other things. It just will. And over time, your heart will get smaller and smaller, and it will get colder. And the day is coming when you and I will face a mountain of regret, not so much for the wrong things that we have done, but for the kind and loving and compassionate things that we chose not to do. In his book, Jim Wallace, the book that I mentioned previous to you, he tells about a lawyer named Dale. Now, Dale was into negotiating really big contracts. He became a prominent sports agent, and he had a really fat income at his work, helping to negotiate contracts for famous athletes. But this man, he began to get out of the house one day, and it absolutely changed his life. He started working at the Good News Soup Kitchen in Tallahassee, Florida. And this is what he writes. I showed up every day in my three-piece suit to help from 11 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. They assigned me door duty. My job was to make sure street people lining up to eat waited in an orderly fashion. Every day I stood at the door for an hour chatting with the street people waiting to eat. Before I came to Good News, street people was a meaningless term. It defined a group without defining anybody in particular from the comfort of my car, from my suburban home, from my downtown law office. Street people were just those people out there somewhere. Then one day an elderly woman named Helen came running to the Good News door. A man was chasing her and threatening to kill her if she didn't give him back his dollar. "Tell him he can't hit me because it's church property," she pleaded. Well, in true lawyerly fashion, I explained that Good News is not actually a church, but he still couldn't hit her. After 20 minutes of failed mediation, I bought peace by giving them each a few dollars. That evening, I happened to be standing on the corner of Park and Monroe, and in the red twilight, I spied a lonely silhouette struggling in my direction from Tennessee Street. A poor street person, I thought to myself as the figure inched closer. I was about to turn back to my own concerns when I detected something familiar in that shadowy figure. A red scarf, the clear plastic bag with white border, the mismatched shoes. "My God," I said in my thoughts, "that's Helen." My eyes froze on her as she limped by and turned up Park. No doubt she'd crawl under a bush to spend the night. My mind had always dismissed the sight of a street person in seconds. I could not expel the picture of Helen. That night, as I lay in my deluxe adjustable temperature-controlled bed, I just couldn't sleep. A voice kept asking, "Where is Helen sleeping tonight?" No street person had ever interfered with my sleep. But the shadowy figure with the red scarf and the plastic bag and the mismatched shoes had followed me home. I made a fatal mistake. I learned her name. That's what happens when you choose to get involved. You learn somebody's name, and when you learn somebody's name, you're never quite the same. Why is it that one name, one face, can be so powerful to us? I think I know why. I think it's because that face was made in the very image of God. I think it's because that name that is the name of somebody for whom Christ has died. Because Jesus said, in some way, in a way that we don't fully understand, in some way, when you extend yourself to someone else, no matter how ragged they are, no matter how ugly they may look to you, in some mysterious way, whatever you do for the least of these, you do it for me. Mother Teresa used to send members of her small community to a home for the dying. She wrote about a young woman from a very wealthy family in Europe who spent 3 hours caring for a dying man brought in from the streets who was completely covered in maggots. And Mother Teresa said this to this young woman. Mother Teresa said, "You be very careful, young lady. You be very loving when you touch him. For right there is Jesus himself in distressing disguise." That's why you and I need to get out of the house more. That's why we need to learn a name. That's why we need to see a face. There's something that changes within us. For there is Jesus in distressing disguise. Now that's why we as a church at Woodside, we are committed to building a small community of women and men who will reach out and love people in meaningful ways. That is, in fact, why our food pantry, Pastor Ralph mentioned in our announcements, our food pantry will meet this afternoon at 2 p.m. as it always does, every second and fourth Sabbaths, to somehow provide love in tangible ways to hungry people in our community. That is the core of the Jesus message. So I'm here this morning really just to give you one challenge. That one challenge is you need to get out of the house. I don't know what your next step is. Maybe it'll involve taking a plunge. You know, a plunge is having the courage to reach out in your neighborhood, in your place of work, in your local community, and just learn some names. Recognize some faces. Now, for everybody here who is a parent, I want to just give you a word of encouragement. Get your kids out of the house. Get your kids involved. They need to experience these kinds of things as they grow. How many of you have either had or currently have a teenager in your home? How many of you have ever taken your teenagers to the Arden Fair Mall or the Roseville Mall? Yeah. Now, I'll tell you something. It's not a bad thing to go to the mall. I love going to the mall. But the more time, I don't know if you've found this, but the more time that I find I spend in the mall, the more I find my heart saying to me, I need, I want, I've got to have. It's just the way it is for you and I. But we also need to take our little hearts to places that will cause them to say other things. We need to take our hearts and we need to form our kids' hearts by taking them to places where their hearts will say things like, I care, I weep. I've got to give. I've got to serve. I've got to make my life bigger than my own comfort and my own success. Jewel and I took our son Garrett on a trip to Central America during his senior year in high school. We spent 2 weeks with his classmates rebuilding a school in the Honduras that had been devastated, destroyed by a hurricane. Those experiences that we had together with our son absolutely changed our hearts. But you and I have got to make the decision to get out of the house. If this is just one more talk, if this is just one more piece of information that comes and goes and you don't get out of the house, and over time, your heart is just going to get a little bit smaller. And one day, you're going to be faced with a whole lot of regret. To those of us here who are deeply involved in serving the needs of our community, to those here who are actively involved in some kind of ministry, I want to say a word. There may be times where you get tired. There may be times where you feel a little burned out, where you feel a little discouraged because it's not easy work. But I want you to hear from me that it's all worth it. It's all worth it. Great will be your reward in heaven. I promise that at the end of your life, you will not regret one single act of love. You will never regret one moment that you spent, one dollar that you gave, one tear that you shed. You will not regret any of it. Because it is the Jesus way of life. And every one of us who knows and follows him, we know that we also have been on the receiving end of His love and mercy. You see, we don't fully understand the story that Jesus was telling us. We don't really understand it until we understand this, that I too am one of the least of these. This is not a story about big, strong, clever, adequate, bright people helping little, weak, helpless, grateful, dependent people. And folks who enter into some kind of ministry with this romanticized picture about how my strength, my adequacy, my sufficiency is going to bring magic into the lives of these people that I classify as needy and helpless. In his story, Jesus does not divide the human race up into strong, confident people and weak and dependent people. You see, I also have my own brokenness, and you have yours. I have my own neediness, and you have yours. I have my own blindness. And in fact, I think the greatest poverty of all is the poverty of compassion. It is the poverty of spirit. It is the poverty of love. So one day Jesus looked around at the world and he saw all of our needs and he saw all of our loneliness and he saw all of our sin and our guilt and our poverty. And Jesus lived, think about this, Jesus lived at the right hand of God in all of this unspeakable glory and splendor. But one day Jesus said, Father, I've got to get out of the house. And Jesus crossed every barrier, and he crossed everything to extend himself in love to every human being who would ever receive him. He came to the city, and he came to the suburb, and he came to the hood, and he came to the barrio, and he came to the mall. He came to needy people like you and I, all of us, the least of these. Jesus comes to us, and he says, now why don't you do what I do? Why don't you devote your life and your heart cultivating love and compassion? Why don't you just extend your hand? Maybe it's a simple thing to someone right down the street from you. Why don't you be part of my team? Jesus says the people with the biggest regret in the world one day will be the people who will say, if I'd only known it was you.